Welcome.
It is 25 minutes after the hour. It is a therapeutic Thursday, which, in as I mentioned on the sign-on this morning, it, in Bible times would have been known, Robbie, correct me if I'm wrong, as fifth day.
Right? Fifth day. There That's a new one to me.
First day, so second day, third day. No, you'll see in the Bible, they talk reference to the days of the week by numbers, because this is before the Vikings had invented Thor.
Vikings.
Because eventually, the Vikings took over all of Europe and much of the Middle East, and they said, enough with fifth day, we're naming Thursday, Thor's day. And so yeah. Now that, so this is yet another day named after a pagan god, like Wednesday, and like Friday, and like Saturday. So I'm looking for some government office where we can petition and to change them. Let's go back to first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh. Is what I'd like to do.
Mm-hmm. Keep it easy, you know.
Yeah. Robbie Pruitt is an Anglican priest. He's based in Ashburn, Virginia.
Yeah, you said it right, Ashburn.
Okay, good. And also the executive director of Preserving Bible Times. He joins us just about every Thursday morning, and we're delighted with that because we learn stuff. We go deeper, particularly into biblical context. We learn to read what's between the lines, and today could be a stellar day because we're talking about Matthew 17 and specifically the Transfiguration. Now, that's when Jesus went to a mountaintop with Peter, James, and John. Was Andrew there? Let's see. I've lost track.
Peter, James, and John.
Just the three of them. And something very special happened there. And Robbie, as we're taught by our contextual studies, when you go to look at a verse, in this case, it's Matthew 17, the first 11 verses or so, you really should start with the previous chapter. Because 17 begins with this phrase, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. Now, after 6 days, is there for a reason? Does it tell us what day of the week? Does it tell us what was happening 6 days before? So what I did is I went back to 16, chapter 16, to see where they were coming from. There was a series of teachings to his disciples specifically. Doesn't mention large crowds and all that. They were in Caesarea Philippi, and he was really coming to focus with his inner core of disciples. And this is when he basically appointed Jesus as the rock that he was going to build his church on. And then the verse that lit up to for me is verse 28. Truly I tell you, some who are standing here, and they were just his disciples standing there, will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And then voila, we go to 17, and he's there with James and John and Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Are those the three that are about to see him coming as the Son of Man? Because something special is about to happen here.
Yeah, it's a good question. And you're right to go back to 16. Chapter 16, I think, is the hinge pin. Many people believe that when Peter asked if he could build three shelters, that he says, Rabbi, it is good that we are here. Let me build three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. For on the Mount of Transfiguration, there appeared with him Moses and Elijah. So many folks believe that Peter is actually referencing the Feast of Sukkot, Tabernacles, the Feast of Booths. And I actually believe that he's trying to build a niche similar to the niches there in Caesarea Philippi, where they have just come from. Because if you go to Caesarea Philippi today, you can see the niches that are carved out into the stone walls right near the gates of hell there.
They were dwelling places, weren't they?
Exactly. Dwelling places for little gods.
Peter often takes heat. They ridicule him for what he just said. I've never understood that. Why is this a bad thing that he would suggest this? Why does it make him look silly? I don't see that.
With the building of the booths?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, exactly, because if he's referencing Sukkot or the Feast of the Tabernacles or the Feast of the Booths, then he just wants to dwell there with Jesus and Moses and Elijah, and there is no problem. Who would not want to hang out with their rabbi and the creator of the law, and the greatest prophet, or the early classical prophet of Elijah. Who would not want to hang out on the mountaintop with them? Now, there's also debate around which mountain they are at. We do not know which mountaintop they are there. It could be Tabor, mm-hmm. or it could be Mount Hermon. I'm actually of the school that it's most likely Mount Hermon, which is snow-capped year-round, and it's closer to the north to where they have just come
from. They were just in Caesarea Philippi, which is up in the northern part of Galilee, and Mount Hermon is a little farther north of there, right on the top edge of Israel.
Oh, it's beautiful. Snow-capped mm-hmm. year-round. You can go skiing there
It's the picture right now on the Preserving Bible Times website. You can take a look at what Mount Hermon looks like if you go to Preserving Bible Times. You've got to spell it out. PreservingBibleTimes.org. You'll get a look at that.
That's a wonderful location. Mm-hmm. And I've been to Caesarea Philippi, and it's a beautiful place, lush and green. The headwaters of the Jordan River, which come from the snow melts of Mount Hermon, that raises the water table, and there waters come out of the mountainside there at Caesarea Philippi. And it's lush and beautiful, beautiful blue water. It flows down through Dan, down to the Sea of Galilee. This is also, by the way, the context of Joshua and the priest coming into the promised land through the flooded waters of the Jordan. We actually know that that's springtime because of the snow melts on Mount Hermon flooding the Jordan River, that the Israelites come into the promised land.
Something else we know about Caesarea Philippi is the very famous cave in the cliffside there, which Roman and perhaps even Sumerian history considered to be the entrance to hell. And Jesus refers to the gates of hell when he's talking to his disciples at that location. So we can envision that in the background. That's kind of a contextual clue as to what the scene was like as he spoke with his disciples.
Absolutely. And there's temples to Pan there. And if you look today to the ruins of some of the temples coming out of the mountainside, the gates of hell would be on your left if you're facing the mountain, and on the right to those, that cave entrance, or the, quote, gates of hell, are three niches carved out into the mountain wall. And those are for idols, or for little gods. So when Peter says, it's good for us to be here, let me build three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah, I believe it's not a reference to Sukkot or the Feast of the Booths or Tabernacles. I believe Peter is referencing Caesarea Philippi. So where he gets it right, when Jesus quizzes him and says, who do people say that I am? And Peter says, some say Moses, some say Elijah, some say John the Baptist. Jesus then says, who do you say that I am? And he says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus says to Peter, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed these things to you. And so Peter gets it right, but then he gets it wrong. Immediately after, Jesus shares that he's going to go to the cross, that he's going to die. And Peter says, far be it from me, I'll never let this happen. And this is where Jesus rebukes Peter and says, get thee behind me, Satan. Now, 6 days after these things, when they go up to this high mountain, which again, I believe is Mount Hermon in the north.
Could well take 6 days to get there from Caesarea, but well, on foot, they walked.
Yeah, and depends on how high they are up this mountain. It's a 10,000-foot mountain. It's just short or just shy of 10,000 feet. Now, Mount Tabor, which is more in the Galilee, southern Galilee region, is only 2,000 feet above sea level, where Mount Hermon is close to 10. So it could have taken them,
well,
you know, the better part of their journey.
It does say a high mountain.
Yeah.
I've never heard him reference it to Tabor as a high mountain. It's a big hill, you know.
Right. It's more like a foothill. I mean, it's what we would know as the Shenandoahs here. We have the Shenandoah Mountain Range, which pale in comparison that if you go to like Pikes Peak in Colorado and look at some of those high mountains, it's night and day.
Mm. old mountains there in Shenandoah. I mean, Shenandoah is a gorgeous place, gorgeous place. Shelters. What do you now? Something Matthew may have been written in Hebrew to begin with. Probably the oldest manuscript is Greek, I would guess. What do you suppose the word original word for shelters was? Could it have been whatever they called niches? Is there some linguistic clue that we can hit on there? Three shelters?
Well, yeah, I haven't really researched that to speak to it. But again, many scholars and many commentators believe that that's actually booths
in reference to festival. Yeah.
But again, what happens next? God speaks during the transfiguration. Jesus radiates before them. He transfigures before them. And then God basically echoes what he says about Jesus at his baptism 3 years previous. This is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. But in the transfiguration account, he says, listen to him. And this is, of course, Moses and Elijah. They disappear. And they are left with Jesus alone, which seems to be a message that Jesus is the perfect fulfillment of the law and the prophets. So in other words, if Jesus is perfectly fulfilling the law, remember
Wait, Moses represented law.
Right.
And Elijah was a prophet.
Right.
Uh-huh.
So if Jesus is the greater law and he's the greater prophet, in Jesus, according to Hebrews, we have the perfect prophet, priest, and king. So if Jesus is our prophet, priest, and king, the perfect prophet, priest, and king, then he is the fulfillment of the law, and he is the fulfillment of the prophets. So when Moses and Elijah gather with Jesus, you've got the law and the prophets there with him.
They would have been the icons for law and prophecy to the disciples and to the Jewish culture.
Absolutely, uh-huh. And the priesthood.
Mm-hmm. A silly question coming up here. How do you suppose Peter, James, and John looked at these two figures and said, oh, that's Moses and that's Elijah? Mm. Tell me they weren't wearing name tags. How would they know that?
Yeah, and Moses wouldn't have had the tablets in his hand. He didn't.
No.
He certainly didn't die with them. Would Elijah have appeared in that chariot of fire, which is the last time we saw him, by the way, is he's taken up in a chariot of fire. I doubt that these two things are the case. I doubt that Moses has the Ten Commandments because, again, he didn't die with them. Elijah's not there in the chariot of
flame. So what clues? Now, maybe Jesus prepped these people before they went up the mountain.
He could have. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he could have. But hindsight's 20/20. You've heard the saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, after the fact, when they inquire, well, who is this, Lord? And remember, Peter, James, and John are there, but Matthew's not. So Matthew, in order to write his gospel, has to hear the testimony. Now,
somebody leaked.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And it's important that we know that Peter actually gives us his testimony. We see that Peter gives the testimony that he witnessed these things on the high mountain. So if you look at...
Now that's in 1 Peter, is it? It's not in the book of Mark, is it?
Right, no. This is not Peter's gospel, which is actually Mark's gospel.
Mm-hmm.
It's Peter. Mm-hmm. It's Peter's letter. 2 Peter 1.
2 Peter, okay.
Yeah. Chapter 1, verses 16 through 18, and Peter says this, "For we did not follow cleverly devised myths when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. For when he received honor and glory from the Father, and the voice was borne to him by the majestic glory," and that's capitalized, "this is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. We ourselves have heard this voice, born from heaven, for we were with him on the holy mountain."
Hmm.
And so this is Peter's testimony of being at the Mount of Transfiguration, when Christ's glory appears and the prophetic word, or the word from God the Father. And this is the third time we actually see the Trinity in one, or the second time we've seen the Trinity, but the third time that the Father speaks audibly in the New Testament. The other time is actually John chapter 12, where Jesus prays and asks the Father to glorify his name, and there's a thunderous voice from heaven that says, "It is glorified." And people think it had thundered. They think an angel speaks to Jesus. So we've got the baptism. This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased. You've got the prayer of Jesus in John 12, glorify thy name. It is glorified. And then you have the transfiguration. This is my beloved Son. Listen to him.
And that's the only phrase in there with an exclamation point. It's amazing to me how Matthew, in writing this, didn't get all excited. I mean, this is such a journalistic report of an amazing event. I mean, this and it obviously stuck in Peter's mind for many, many years until First and Second Peter came out, or Second Peter in this case. But Jesus had instructed them, don't tell anyone what you've seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. So after that, maybe that's when they finally took Matthew and said, "Hey, we got something for you here."
Yeah, I've got to tell you a story since you're writing that gospel down, right?
I had to have to laugh when I watched the Chosen, because they have the character of Matthew all through Jesus' ministry carrying a tablet and a writing implement. I'm trying to figure out what that was that he could carry around with him without an ink bottle, but he keeps writing on this tablet. You know, they didn't have Bics back then, did they?
It's wax, actually. It's wax that they're carving into.
A stylus, then. So we had a stylus.
Oh. Absolutely.
Oh. And then perhaps they would do it like an ink wash over it, so the letters would... revelation here. I feel better about the Chosen now.
All kinds of note-taking tools, but we don't know a lot of that for sure. We actually had a reproduction of that in first century Nazareth at Museum of the Bible, and we would show that off.
They would coat a piece of ceramic or clay with wax, and then carve letters in it, and then they had to make them more visible, so they would coat it with some sort of dye or ink or something. You know, we underestimate all those people, what they had from day to day and how they survived and what they passed on to us. This is such a neat thing. Okay.
That's something that I just picked up from the book on ancient Rome that I've been reading, is that Josephus and some of the historians of the day used that technique to write for publication.
I wonder how they reproduced it. They'd have to hand write copies, I suppose.
Yeah, and they would just hand write. They would have somebody else do the same copies over and over and over again. But those are some of the first documents that are actually still around.
Nice.
And because they're on something solid, something that doesn't decay.
Well, let's explore, too, why Matthew's writing this stuff down. Why does it matter to Matthew? I mean, if you consider that, the transfiguration doesn't make John's gospel, and he's one of the eyewitnesses. He gets the firsthand account, but Peter has it in his gospel, the Gospel of Mark. John Mark is Peter's scribe. Matthew has the transfiguration. Luke has the transfiguration, but John doesn't.
Matthew begins with a genealogy of Jesus. So largely his whole point is to prove that Jesus is the Messiah who was prophesied. Now, here in this example, God speaks and says, "This is my Son." I mean, maybe that's because it reinforces his point, you suppose?
Well, yes, and I think it goes all the way back to Exodus. So Exodus 34... When Moses goes up on a high mountain and he meets with God, he goes up to Sinai to receive the law, the tablets, the Ten Commandments. Again, this is God's stylus. This is his finger. He carves the Ten Commandments into the solid stone, and he gives them to Moses to present to the people. So Moses is speaking with God, and so Exodus tells us in Exodus 34 that that during this time when Moses came down from Mount Sinai, verse 29 of chapter 34, with the two tablets of testimony in his hands, he came down the mountain, and Moses did not know that his skin, the skin of his face, shone because he had been talking with God. Aaron and all the people of Israel saw Moses, and behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. But Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the leaders of the congregation returned to him, and Moses talked with them. And after all the people of Israel came near, he commanded them that the Lord had spoken with him at Mount Sinai. And when Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil over his face because his face was radiating with God's glory, emphasis added there. When Moses went back before the Lord to speak with him, he would remove the veil until he came back out. And when he came back out and told the people of Israel that what he was commanded, the people of Israel could see the face of Moses, that the skin of Moses' face was shining, and Moses would put the veil over his face again until he went to speak with him. That's Exodus 34, 29 through 35. What's happening on the Mount of Transfiguration?
There's a whole lot of radiating going on.
Yes, mm-hmm. God is speaking to his son, and his son is also radiating with the glory of God. And I believe this is Trinitarian. I believe that the radiant light, the glory that is shining forth, much like the glory cloud that came down upon the temple in the days of Solomon, we also see a cloud of glory, a bright light at the Mount of Transfiguration. If you go back and look at that account.
And that's referred to as the Shekinah glory. Is that correct?
Yes. Reference to the Shekinah glory cloud, or even go back to Moses in the pillar of cloud by day, pillar of fire by night. But if you look at the chapter 17 account, you will see that there is a radiant glory cloud there appearing with them. So after 6 days, it says that Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, his brother, led them up to the high mountain by themselves, was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun. Notice the emphasis on his face. Sounds like what we just read in Exodus 34 mm-hmm. in the account of Moses, with Moses' face reflecting or radiating the glory of God as God the Father spoke with Moses. So the radiant face of Jesus, as God the Father speaks with his Son, and his clothes became white as light. And then if you go down to verse 5, you see a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." So you have the bright shining face, you have the clothes radiating, and you have a glory cloud and a booming, thunderous voice coming from the cloud and proclaiming, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. Listen to him." And then Moses and Elijah are gone, and there is Jesus only, the perfect fulfillment of the law and the prophets.
Can we sneak into verses 9, 10, 11? Jesus says, coming down from the mountain, don't tell anybody until after the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. Now, he had just informed them that he was going to be killed and raised in 3 days. So he's reemphasized mm-hmm. that there. But then the disciples asked him, why then do the teachers of the law say Elijah must come first? They were still looking for an Elijah. Were they not? I mean, what the order of, what was their expectation revealed to us in verse 10 there?
Well, it's Malachi that Elijah, the prophet, is going to come. And so Jesus has already told us that if you're willing to accept it, John the Baptist is Elijah. But here again, we have Elijah showing up on the Mount of Transfiguration. So listen, if you're a skeptic and you think John the Baptist is just John the Baptist and you're still waiting on the Messiah, well, see the Mount of Transfiguration. Elijah comes. Elijah himself at the Mount of Transfiguration. Now, I'm a little baffled here that John would not also include the transfiguration for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Because John is also writing that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, but he doesn't include the transfiguration.
Now, I'm going to bring you back to a couple of podcasts ago when we were talking about John the Baptist. And when he sent his representative, he was imprisoned by Herod, and he mm-hmm. sent representatives to Jesus, wherever he was at the time, to ask him if he was the one that John had been anticipating. And Jesus said what I had, to that point, always considered a little strange. He started talking about the blind are can see, and the lame are healed, and the rising from the... And you informed us that he was quoting Isaiah.
Yeah.
And that he was doing it specifically to encourage John while he was in prison, because a portion of what Isaiah had was about the coming of Elijah.
Well, it's the fulfillment of Isaiah 40, where John comes. He claims that he is the voice of one crying in the wilderness, make straight the way of the Lord. So by saying that, it's Isaiah 40, 3 through 5, a voice cries in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be filled up, every mountain and hill be made low, and the uneven places shall become level, and the rough places a plain. So this is what Jesus is throwing back at John the Baptist, is another verse in Isaiah, that Isaiah is saying that the Messiah will fulfill these things, that the blind will see, the lame will walk. So he's saying, if you're the voice of one and crying in the wilderness, look at what I'm fulfilling, which is also in your book, your prophet, mm-hmm. your book of prophecy. And it also goes back to Malachi 3:1, where in Malachi 3:1, Malachi says, behold, I send my messenger, he will prepare a way before me. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. And the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight, behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. So here you see that he is going to prepare a way, this messenger. And so this is the fulfillment of John the Baptist, that makes straight in the desert a way for the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is one of the beauties of talking with Robbie. When we can see when statements of Jesus actually are legitimate. I mean, they refer to something a prophet said, and those around him hearing him say that would have understood that. We don't get that necessarily unless we can recite the Torah from memory, and the prophets and the wisdom books. You can see why those were included in the scripture and the significance of those statements once you make the connection with the Old Testament, which is something we get when we listen to Robbie. And that's just great, great stuff. Robbie, this is anything else you want to cover on the Transfiguration?
Well, there's so much to cover. We've covered a lot of ground, gentlemen. It's just been a pleasure to be with you and a delight. Thanks for having me on.
Well, that was something. And again,
glad to have you here.
This will be a podcast up at BrokenRoadRadio.com. You can go to the podcast archives even today and see a chronological list of all the past conversations with Robbie, his teachings. Click on one and you can hear the audio. You can download it, you can share it, and we recommend you do exactly that. And Robbie, thank you. We'll see you next week. Have a blessed week. Okay?
Joy and a pleasure, gentlemen.
Bye-bye.
Godspeed.
Thanks for being here, Robbie.